hppodcraft.com.
Well, hello, folks. Welcome to HP Podcraft, Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. This is our comment show for October, covering last month's shows exclusively on Patreon.
Lots to talk about, so let's jump right into Dorian Gray, Part 1. Devin Morse writes, I had a feeling it would be Greg. Y'all should make a mockumentary about him utilizing all of Chad's outrageous claims. I don't know how outrageous they are. Dorian Gray is one of my favorite books. There are so many lines from it that stand out on their own as classic wild witticisms. It's the only book I stopped reading every few pages to write down a quote.
Corey Wittig writes, so glad you're all covering this, and Jamie was great. Jamie was great. There's so many comments about how awesome Jamie is, and I agree with all of them. Corey goes on to say, I found this copy of The Picture of Dorian Gray on my dad's bookshelf when I was like 12. I was drawn in by Wilde's look, and I thought he'd look cool and kind of how I wanted to be. My dad encouraged me to read it after a weird exchange. My dad, you should know that he was gay. Me, oh, okay. My dad, but you should read it. Me, oh, okay. I think he was working out getting past a latent generational homophobia in real time. I didn't read the book for real until I was 14 or 15. By this point, I had connected the dots between Morrissey, the Smiths, and Wilde. Isn't it funny when you're drawn to art and find the inevitable connecting points between the music, movies, paintings, and other creators? Morrissey is another who is rather Lord Henry-like in his dickishness, but he really meant a lot to me as a younger man. Like Morrissey, I got really into reading and quoting Wilde in rural central Pennsylvania. Yeah, it went great.
Yeah, I can relate.
And come on, There Is a Light is one of the greatest songs of all time. You can't just offhandedly diss it and then casually mention new metal in a knowing way and be taken seriously. Yeah. I do love that song. I didn't say anything. Jamie comes on my show. I'm not going to insult his musical likes and dislikes. However, I love the Smiths. I love that song. Morrissey, not so much.
Well, in defense of Jamie, I don't think he said he disliked the song. I just think he said, who wants to listen to that? Which is a little like sometimes, you know, there's like a very dramatic, serious movie and you go, I don't want to put that on. You know, I think he was more in the spirit of, that's a little bit of a played out song. Wolf Mungus writes, one of my favorite moments from Married with Children is a scene in which Bud stares narrow-eyed at Kelly after she makes a dumb comment and says, once your looks go, you're dead. I wonder now if this was a reference by the writer of Lord Henry to Dorian commenting on how he only has his looks. Yeah, may very well be.
It sure sounds like it. And I'm sure the writers of Married with Children were literary connoisseurs.
They probably are. Yeah. Most TV writers, even if they're writing something dumb, are often very highly educated.
Yeah, sure.
A lot of them have literature degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And they went, I want to make some money with writing.
Ben A. writes, I've been waiting for you guys to cover Dorian Gray, as it's the only Wilde story that fits broadly within weird fiction outside of the Canterville Ghost. It definitely also fits the caution you have raised in the past about not having more than one supernatural occurrence in a story. The one supernatural element is the transference of age and sin into the painting. The rest of the story is a normal examination of morality and integrity, as well as repressed sexuality and classism.
There was that one scene where they saw his elderly shins. That was kind of a weird thing that happened when they all went swimming.
But that also actually fits into the one supernatural thing.
Yeah, you're right. It is a part of that.
It's
That's
a part
why
of
it doesn't
that.
Violate
yeah.
the rule.
It you're doesn't so violate right. the rule.
I just because I just edited that episode, I just was really enjoying how excited you were to present that scene. You go, wait, and then they're swimming. There's a swim, and everybody's like, why isn't he wearing shorts? You were so excited.
I was so happy about it.
I was like, man, you're just making that connection. I got an idea, guys. There's a swim scene.
I don't get to pitch much these days, so, you know, when I get an opportunity, I really go for it.
Yeah, I was open to it.
Ben A. goes on to write, you haven't gotten to Dorian's many transgressions yet, but I thought it would be worth noting that there is a through line that connects Dorian Gray to Ethan Brand in my mind. Hawthorne was focused on trying to understand if there was a level of evil depravity that could be an unpardonable sin. To him, the corruption of a woman through what amounts to psychological torture is such a transgression. In Dorian Gray, this is reflected both by Dorian's self-corruption through his fixation of Lord Henry's musings and, later, his courting and rejection of Sybil Vane. Her corruption, in many respects, is the same as Ethan Brand's unpardonable sin. Both Gray and Brand suffer for their selfishness and their hubris.
Shayna Carter writes, a story in which an overly perceptive artist paints a portrait that reveals the horrible secrets of its subject, leading to murder. Wait, what do you mean we're not revisiting Medusa's Coil? You even name-dropped Dorian Gray about 21 minutes into episode 73.
Oh, wow. Good callback.
Yeah.
I totally forgot about that.
Benjamin Atkinson writes, I think I understand Wilde's preface slightly differently. He is saying art is useless in that it lacks a practical application or strict utility, but I don't think he is saying art is pointless. He assigns art a very specific purpose, which is to be beautiful or pleasing. In this way, I think he hints art as very important, just that any art with an ulterior motive or utility is lesser. Yeah, thanks for that comment. It was a reminder to address that, which we did in a later show. You know, sometimes we lose stuff in the edit, but we actually did talk about that. It was just that we were spending too much time on the preface, so it was funnier when you said, you got jazzed! So that was a much better thing to pursue.
Tom Kroll writes, this is my first time rereading Dorian Gray since I was like 15 or 16. It seems crazy to me how much I actually took Lord Henry's words as being legitimate worldviews and actually assumed some of them as my own. Even when the character and the whole plot of the book says otherwise, he still convinced me that the stuff he says is true. I guess it really takes some maturity to be able to see through all of that. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that it's a... within the book, Dorian gets taken in by a book, and it's just as easy for a young person to get taken in by this book. So that later in life, you go, whoa, that was like a virtual reality novel. Liana writes, I'm so glad you're doing this one. When I discovered it back in high school, this novel fascinated me so much that I ended up staging a mini play based on it with some colleagues for our literature class.
Oh, wow.
Colleagues. It was all super metaphorical and obfuscated and not as smart as we thought in retrospect, but I ended up having a soft spot for Dorian Gray ever since. Aww. I had a soft spot for that comment because I remember doing my little mini plays in high school. I think Liana and I are very similar. I like that use of the word colleagues.
Alishiba writes, my Google foo is failing me. Does anyone know where I can pirate or purchase the 1918 Dorian Gray with Bela Lugosi? Rafe Ball writes, your Google fool is not at fault. Unfortunately, the film is long lost.
Yep, I found that out too. I wouldn't have shared that image out of Bella as Lord Henry had I known that nobody could get that movie. I felt irresponsible in having done that.
You son of a bitch.
I felt the disappointment too to find out that film is lost. Gosh, that would be great to see. Devin Trim writes, wow, the impression you guys did of Dorian sobbing at Sylvia's acting sounded great. Sounded just like my first time reading that scene in this book. I even fainted afterward and then slipped on my own tears as I was getting back up. Good times. That's what I'm saying. This book is so immersive.
John Hancock writes, when Dorian was shoehorned into the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen film, ignoring the actual point of his character in favor of a cheap superpower, there was an interview with Alan Moore who was bemused by the decision to include him. In a way, it seemed like the filmmakers had the same superficial reaction to the painting's abilities that Dorian himself had, pushing aside any reservations and choosing to concentrate purely on the apparent benefits. People who find the ending of the story absurd seem to be so in love with the concept that they can't imagine any downside worth worrying about. Moore himself was baffled as to how such a character could be used in a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen scene, imagining the typical interactions as, hello, Dorian, you're looking well.
Devin Morris writes, the opening of this episode gave me a mental image of Greg just standing in a room having a conversation with himself, and I love it.
Aww.
I think he'd like that too.
I think he does that a lot, actually.
Yeah. Sam Harris writes, I've been listening to HPL's letters over on Voluminous, and there's more than a little of Lord Henry's claims that ethical concerns are secondary to aesthetic ones in Lovecraft's self-presentation at many stages of his life. He's frequently going on about how he doesn't like bad actions, not because they're wrong, but because they're unaesthetic. I can see that.
Michael Littlefield writes, I'm overjoyed that you're finally covering The Picture of Dorian Gray. It's one of my favorite novels, and the 1945 adaptation still has a special place in my nightmares. Those colorized shots of the portrait! I'm surprised that you haven't gone more into the narcissist myth with this story, as there are a lot of similarities between Dorian and Narcissus, such as Basil being somewhat akin to Echo, Sybil being Amenius, while her brother Harry is Nemesis, or the portrait being akin to the pool of water where he sees himself. The story of Dorian Gray is very much a Greek tragedy where hubris is the sin that leads the main character and nearly everyone around them to some form of mutual destruction. Agamemnon, Jason and Medusa, Icarus, etc. I would very much like to see this story being retold in a modern landscape where Dorian is an average person. The portrait is their online profile made by their best friend who thinks they should get on social media. Lord Henry could be one of the influencers who sold the fiasco that was the Fire Festival.
Fire Festival had Dorian Gray written all over it. There was, yeah, definitely. That's really funny. I don't know anybody from What We Do in the Shadows, but I was telling you this yesterday. I think they've actually done a Fyre Festival-esque kind of episode on there. But I was watching the movie 30 Days of Night the other day, and I thought, it would be really funny if the vampires in that show booked a 30 Days of Night kind of vacation, like another northern Alaskan town, and they were really excited about it. But when they got there, it was kind of like New Zealand after Lord of the Rings came out. It's just super touristy, and there's way too many vampires. There's no humans. It wasn't planned well. They have to spend 30 days there with nothing to do. It's like a reverse of that movie. I think it'd be really funny. Uh-huh. On to part three of The Picture of Dorian Gray. John Hancock writes, an amazing ploy from Dorian there. There's a body upstairs. A man who killed himself by brutally stabbing himself in the back of his neck repeatedly while banging his face against a table. It's the old, old story. Eric Jordan Phillips writes, a longtime listener, first time commenter here. A cult for controlling emotions, you say? Perhaps I shall start building an army of good feelings to come your way. Truly delighted to see another upload. Yeah. I like
that's
it.
Awesome.
That's a good cult.
Yeah. Sanjay Matthew writes, got them to kiss a goat or something? Where posh English people are concerned, that was something that I said on the show about the decadent things Dorian was doing, because I don't really go into specifics. They just say he does bad things. And I said, well, maybe he got them to kiss a goat. And Sanjay is quoting that. And then he says, where posh English people are concerned, this just means that he was at Oxford with them. See Cameron, David. And that was the former prime minister who allegedly put his penis and or testicles inside the mouth of a dead pig as part of an initiation. Just in case you didn't know about that.
I did know about that. And I wish I didn't, but I do. Ethan Corddry writes, I loved the connection you guys made at the beginning that Dorian is basically succeeding in classic self-help psychology. And that's what makes him a moral monster. He's truly living his best life now. Yeah, man, that stuff scares me. Anytime I see the cover of a magazine that's all about that kind of stuff and the computer looking Stepford Wife type people they put up there, I go, their lives look horrifying to me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think there's some profound connection between the aspirational ideas of pop psychology, self-confidence, control, positivity, and the troubling reality of psychopathic personality disorder, where a psychopath is literally incapable of doubting themselves or being influenced by other people's emotional reactions to their behavior. Many psychologists think that psychopaths simply don't feel normal emotions at all, except for the basic feelings of excitement and boredom. But the fact that psychopaths are free from the hang-ups of normal emotions, and thus of normal social pressures, might explain why normal people tend to find psychopaths charming and charismatic. There's an attractiveness to that freedom, and when we imagine ourselves free in a similar way, it seems ideal. Of course, when we imagine ourselves that way, we're projecting upon that imaginary self-image a whole bunch of psychological elements that actual real psychopaths don't really have. If you have a normally functioning amygdala, achieving that sort of self-possession is actually extremely difficult, as everyone from the ancient Stoics to the more honest types of self-help writers have understood, and also probably won't have the pleasant results that you think it would. Anyway, this makes me think that there is a market for a Dorian Gray self-help book, teaching people how to project all their fears, insecurities, and social pressures onto a creepy painting you keep in your attic while you live your life of freedom and luxury. The Secret of Dorian Gray in bookstores now. I love it. Oh. There's a market for that. You know how they did Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Killer, and Pride and Prejudice and Zombies? You can be the one to merge classic horror literature with self-help.
Genius! Zane Graves writes, oh, Chad, I'll miss you. Not enough to stop Jamie from murdering you and taking on your hosting duties, but enough. Wait a minute. Murder? Was that
there was a murder involved? Wow.
I just thought you were fired, but
yeah,
okay.
I thought I got to hang out still and listen to the show.
But Zane goes on to write, not enough to stop Jamie from murdering you and taking on your hosting duties, but enough to casually but ominously mention to Chris, Chad was really great. I wonder what happened to him while sipping a cocktail at some live show. It's the least I could do. He's saying he would try and make me feel nervous about murdering you.
Well, let me be clear. I mean, I'll go easily. You don't have to consider this. I'm prepared mentally. When the day comes, I'll be like, see ya. I got, boxes here. I get it. I don't know why I box up my things. I'm in my own home office. I still box them up.
Oh, golly. Ben Munn writes, great show as always. You three make me want to sin so much my driver's license photo has turned into the Crypt Keeper.
Wow.
Anyway, just a quick note. I took the mention of Dorian corrupting Lord Henry's sister as an expression of how far past Lord Henry's hedonism he'd moved. Sort of like teaching the teacher and not really in need of any follow-up. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
It's kind of hack stand-up comedy, but really, what is going on with that driver's license camera? You know? I look like some debauched Fred Flintstone in my picture, and I'm too lazy to go get a new one, so that's just what it is. Peter Larson writes, I like that Lord Henry's corruption of Dorian is less come to the dark side, wahahahaha, and is more just the everyday normalizing of shitty entitled behavior that goes on all the time in the real world. Despite the decadence and gothic elements, Dorian's fall is mostly him going, wait, I could just not care? Really? Awesome! It's not an argument that works on everyone, thank heavens, but the number of people who are relieved of responsibility or consequences will do just about anything is, well, larger than I'd like.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Jeez. Good. Yeah, good point.
Forrest Rush writes, goat kissing and Fleetwood Mac / Human League mashup? You guys are just amazing. I repeat my claim that American Psycho is Ellis's more Dorian novel, especially based on the listing of Chapter 11, as well as the similar reasons the writers use such a device.
Oh, yeah, right. You know, American Psycho is so much about cataloging all these things, music and...
Oh, that's interesting.
There are similarities. I was really seeing those connections. Bret Easton Ellis kind of disturbs me as a writer in a lot of ways, but American Psycho is pretty awesome. I had more of an appreciation for it after reading Dorian Gray. Stacey Cahan writes, if that is indeed how her name is pronounced, we're going to talk about that in a second. She says, wow, longtime listener, first time caller. How funny that the very same episode on which Chad mispronounced my name, no worries, everyone does, was also the one that prompted a thought I just had to share. She didn't let me know how to pronounce it. So
yeah.
I probably did say Cahan. It's C-A-H-A-N. But maybe it's like Kahan or Khan. Khan! I'm going to go with Khan.
Hopefully she'll write us and let us know how to pronounce her name.
Whether you want to do that or not is up to you, but I will read this that you wrote. She had to stop mid-run this morning to set a reminder to write this comment, so I want to make sure we get it in there. This installment of Dorian Gray reminded me a bit of themes raised in E.F. Benson's The Man Who Went Too Far. In particular, the notion that bad deeds / bad thoughts have an impact on one's appearance. In Wilde's work, it's that sort of active participation / intent, while in Benson's, it's just being around bad feelings in general. I can just picture Benson's Frank wearing one of those good vibes only tank tops while lounging in his hammock just before getting trampled by Pan. Oh, yeah. I didn't make the connection. I kind of forgot about that story, but that's what was going on in there.
Yeah.
Good connection. Right.
Comment show 29, Corporate Monstrorum. Make America great old ones again. I try to assume that no matter how interesting my life is, it will probably bore the pants off anybody else. Thanks for the interest in my aquarium story. Since you were curious about the Yakuza element, I'll give you some broad strokes. When I first came to Japan, I lived in a smallish city outside Hiroshima. That was a lousy with Yakuza. They made no effort to hide their association. Hooray for bright yellow suits. And I often ran into groups of them on my walk home from work. They were always kind to me, and we had some good laughs. They both played a role in getting my wife and I together and in providing a venue for our wedding. It was a beautiful venue, and they tossed in a suite at a hotel for us, which sounds awesome, but it should be said that it's not really like we could have said no. Mm. Oof. Yeah. Anywho, that's all helped me prepare for dealing with the Yakuza in Tokyo Entertainment and explains why I'm not actively scared of working with them. Except for that agency with the aquarium, they terrify me.
I got it. That makes sense.
I'm so fascinated. I have so many follow-up questions to that.
Sure. But I mean, it's a little like the apartment we used to live in down the street from here. There were drug dealers on the stoop.
Oh, yeah.
And they were just nice guys. You know what I mean? You just get used to it. You go, hey, what's up? And you get to know each other. And it's normalized, I guess. So, like he's describing.
Well, I mean, there's also an element to that those guys want their neighbors happy. Because if they're jerks, then we're going to be more likely to call the cops and give them problems.
That's true.
If they're nice to us, they're friendly, then we'll like them and we'll, you know, kind of look the other way if they do anything shitty. So.
Which we did. I didn't disapprove of the business, so I guess that's on me too. So anyway, Ed Sizemore writes, can't vouch for the legality of it, but Daily Motion is streaming War Gods from the Deep. Happy to report there's also Blu-ray of the film. That was something I was saying I wanted to see with Vincent Price in it. Alan Ricks writes, looking into it more, this movie seems to be a very loose Poe adaptation of the poem City in the Sea. It was made perhaps to cash in on the Corman Price Poe adaptations. I think that's likely. And Tom Krall writes, I'd say today's we were talking about there's no Schwarzenegger today. And he said, I'd say Schwarzenegger for today is The Rock. He's not that young, but he is this big muscular guy that stars in action movies with a comedic twist. Not as great as Arnold, but good and wholesome nonetheless.
Well, Schwarzenegger wasn't wholesome. He was just bizarre. And it's just the idea that he's this Austrian guy with a super thick accent and he became this international star. Like The Rock. I love The Rock.
I do too.
But he seems too normal. Like he's not weird. He's just like a big buff guy and he's funny and He's a good actor, and I like him. Yeah. But Schwarzenegger is such an anomalous phenomenon. Like, nothing like him. Jean-Claude Van Damme was sort of like this really watered-down version of Schwarzenegger. Like, because he was weird.
He's weird. He's bizarre. Yeah, right. But he has great, you know, he had his signature moves. And
yeah.
He was more like a traditional kung fu star in a certain respect. But Schwarzenegger is just so out of this world. Yeah, he's more like, there are other bodybuilders and there's a tradition of wrestlers going into movies and that kind of thing. It's just that he, being from this totally different country, I don't know, it is very odd.
Thomas Painter writes, haha, honored that you read my comment on the show, even if it does mean I will go down in history as the Thundar the Barbarian guy.
That's the risk when you comment, that because this could be your legacy, guys.
Oh, golly. In all seriousness, he writes, if I could get Chris and Chad to cover one thing, it would be the novel Resume with Monsters by William Browning Spencer. Plunging into Thomas Ligotti's work would be a close second. Anyway, big fan of Thundar and of the podcast. Sean Burkhart writes, aw, thanks for the shout out to my daughter this week. She was absolutely thrilled to hear her name on the podcast. I greatly appreciate both the personal touch and the extra dad points I got for your efforts. No problem.
No problem. What that's dad like. Points are hard to get.
Yeah.
Devin Morse writes, the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast contributions to the historic critique of this novel. We're on Dorian Part 4 now. The parallel between Dorian Gray and Leonard Nimoy's two autobiographies. Yes, I think we were the first to make that connection. The inference that Basil gave his other models heat vision. You're welcome, literature. Lord Henry as a tragic figure in the tradition of the Fonz. Now that, I think, has been addressed in lots of postgraduate work, unfortunately. And James's hunt for Dorian evoking Terminator. Yeah. By the way, speaking of that, I didn't do that mashup of the Human League.
You did not. I thought
no.
I thought you did as well.
No, I appreciate and a lot of people did think that I would do that, but we live in a world where I Googled Human League with Mac mashup, and that was the very first thing that came up. So it was literally 30 seconds of work for me, and I put credit to the artist in the show notes.
Monster Talk writes, and don't forget that Nimoy's directorial debut was on Night Gallery on an episode titled Death on a Barge, based on the canal covered on episode 438 of this very same podcast, which featured an ageless vampire stuck on a barge.
Lots of
it all comes around.
Thank you. John Hancock writes, right you are, random prostitute, is a line I shall be keeping an eye out for in the future. There's no way it can be allowed to slip into obscurity. Agreed. Stacey Schumacher writes, the end of the story reminded me of a Simpsons episode where Mr. Burns creates a net out of plastic garbage. And Lisa says something like, you're horrible. And when you're trying to do something good, you're even more horrible. That's how I perceive Dorian at the end. Like, he is so terrible that any act he thinks would be good is terrible by virtue of being thought of or executed by him. Mm. He thinks he can trick the painting or fate or his own self with a good action. But the picture sees it for what it is, still a selfish act, and throws that up on the image of him. And he's enraged that it calls him out on it. I don't think the ending is intentionally self-destructive. I think it's angry and spiteful. His final act is selfish and thoughtless, because that's what has so imbued who he is by that point, that the consequences, even to himself, are inconsequential to what his impulse is. These have been great episodes. Jamie's been a thoughtful guest, and I thought Greg's readings were fantastic. Well done, all. Thank you.
Very insightful, Stacey. Thank
and
you.
Yeah, that's so true. When somebody's just broken and they try to do something good, yeah, you still see it.
Rave Wolf writes, I first read the story as a kid and was actually pretty disappointed with how it was written, despite having enjoyed some other arguably more dense material from the era. When I read The Thing, it was a bit hard for me to even get through it to the end, to be honest. Maybe it's particularly because we don't get to really know the characters very well, and I found some of the subtext hard to pick up. And yet the story and the ideas in it have haunted me my whole life ever since. And as I slowly came to realize that I found it unforgettable in some weird way. Oh well, the author must have done something right. You know, I had a hard time with this book. I tried to read it a few years ago when we were doing the show, because we were going to do it earlier. I just could not get into it. I don't know what it was about it, something about the writing style. I got an audiobook of it because I'm trying to do more walks. So I figured, well, if I'm on a walk, then I'm going to get... And once I got hooked, I was able to actually just start reading it instead of just listening to it. It's just kind of a rhythm of the writing that you have to get used to. And I totally understand, Rave Wolf, what you're talking about there.
Jason Thompson writes, one of my favorite horror novels ever. Great reading, guys. I was obsessed for most of my youth with the idea expressed in this novel that basically your moral character shows up in your face. You probably heard the idea that the left side of your brain controls the right side of your body. And somewhere I heard or read the corollary that the side of your face controlled by the emotional side of your brain would reflect your morals and personality. emotional lateralism. Basically Dorian Gray, but only on half of you. The serial H.H. Holmes apparently believed this and became obsessed with the idea that half his face was becoming uglier as he killed more people.
Wow. That's weird. Crazy, yeah.
Richard Horseman writes, "Tonight we watched The Sins of Dorian Gray, an early 80s TV movie adaptation of the picture. The hook for this one is that it has a contemporary setting and Dorian is a woman, gasp, instead of a portrait." The magical device is a screen test because in this version, Dorian is an aspiring actress, model. Basil is a female director married to Henry Lord, played by a slumming Anthony Perkins. It's a fascinatingly wrong-footed take. All the queer subtext and text is erased, replaced with a plot that's basically 60% A Star Is Born and 40% Don't You Want Me, Baby. Well, no one in it actually gives a damn about art, and Dorian is more like a Catherine O'Hara character from SCTV than a compelling and repellent figure. Because now I want to see it. You shouldn't have said it. The crowning glory is the increasingly laughable makeup used to age Dorian in the screen test. By the end, she's basically wearing a latex Tor Johnson mask. But the strangest thing, there are scenes that are beat for beat from the book, most notably the morning after the death of lounge singer Stuart Vane, who Dorian has rejected. The people who did this adaptation took the time to read the source, but boy, did they not understand it.
God, I really want to see this now.
I know.
Monster Talk writes, on the hair symbolism, you know, the rodent creature, not hair as in, and on the hair symbolism, in addition to the imagery you guys discussed, it's worth noting that hairs are consistently associated with witch lore in England. Movies tend to make us think of witches turning into cats and whatnot, but hairs are the serious go-to animal for witches. The historical basis of silver being used to kill shapeshifters takes root in the legend, and there are lots of very familiar stories of hares wounded by silver, only to find an old woman in town with a grievous wound to the same spot later. Spoiler, they're witches. That connection was featured in American witch/ghost lore, like the legend of the Bell Witch, and it was eerily portrayed in the 2015 horror film The Witch, that's with the two V's in it. Yeah. I suspect Wilde would have expected English readers to know that connection and that it would have added a magical flavor to the scene.
Zane Graves writes, "What really struck me, especially during the last episode, was how much this felt like Wilde was calling out gay men. It might be how it reads today in a modern context, but I can't help but wonder if the queer world wasn't so dissimilar some 140 years ago as it is today. Having been in and out of various scenes over my life, there's always something appealing about the new face, the new guy who doesn't know the ropes. There are the people who are happy to be a guide, and if they're decent dudes, will warn about any predatory behavior. I remembered moving outside LA in the early 2000s, and upon hitting a major bar and being introduced to people told, you better be careful if you bump into so-and-so. In my youth, I dismissed it as some mean girl behavior, but I quickly learned how often those warnings were justified. In the novel, we don't linger on the fun times of Dorian. We start with him as the new blood, and very quickly go over what could be the fun years, until we get to the jaded, empty man whose youthly pleasures were no longer fun. Substance abuse in the queer community is rather high and part and parcel of contemporary gay culture. So a book about eternal youth and showing no signs of self-destructive behavior? This story is the cleanest metaphor for smoking meth and wearing mirrored aviators because you think no one at the club notices you've been saying you're 29 for 15 years. Yeah.
Wow.
Sure. I'm sure there is some of that going on.
Finally, we talk about Manimal, Knight of the Scorpion. Peter Larson writes, "What did we do to deserve more Manimal? Isn't 2020 enough?"
Get it all out of the way. That's what I say. Just do it all at once.
Yep.
Think of those great, when they think of the 2020s, they'll think it started with a lot of Manimal, but then we had those beautiful post-Manimal years. I mean, just no Manimal.
Yeah, that's true.
Although I was reading, I hate to say this, but you know, there's 8 episodes of Manimal.
Yeah.
He watched all 8 and then he disappeared.
Oh, no.
I'm a little worried that if we do cover it all, something might happen.
Well, I'm hoping that if we watch all 8 and then quickly watch the Nightman episode that has Manimal in it, that maybe if you close it out, that you'll be okay. You know how like in The Ring, if you watch the video, then you would die in 7 days. But if you got somebody else to watch it, then you were okay. So that it's the same kind of thing. If you watch the Nightman episode, you'll be fine.
Or, no, man, closer to The Ring, we're going to be okay. But everybody who listens, if they listen to all 8 podcasts on Manimal, they're all going to get it. We'll be safe because we passed it on.
Oh, geez.
Oh, now I totally want to do it. Ethan Cordry writes, "I think you're overlooking the most obvious conclusion any forensic pathologist would draw. If he found a corpse with rope burns on it along with a big tarantula, autoarachnic asphyxiation."
There you go. Well done.
You did it, Ethan. Mark Saunders writes, as soon as I saw this episode was up, I pulled up my computer and watched Night of the Scorpion. Then I listened to this episode. No word of a lie. Every single thought I had while watching was brought up in this episode with funnier jokes than I could come up.
Oh, thanks.
Well, thanks. Also, that overlap bit had me questioning my sanity. I checked everything. My Wi-Fi, my headphones. I was so confused. Great episode, guys. More Manimal. We were laughing about that while we were recording it, actually.
Yeah. And finally, John Hazard writes, curious, Chris, did you ask Rachel to watch this with you, or does she, or does your other podcast use up all of her patience? I think you could probably guess the answer to that one. It does. It does use up all of her patience. I ask her to watch nothing else. Like, Star Trek, I think, is as far into my world as she's willing to go. Well, that concludes our comments from the month of September. Thank you guys so much for writing in and giving us the stuff.
That's all we have for you this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the comment show for HPPodcraft.com.
Exclusively on Patreon.
HPPodcraft.com.